Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group, was previously recorded on August 15, 2011, during a live conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleform Conference Call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. Today, we're hosting a Practice Group Teleform debate on the death penalty, which has been much in the news lately. Debating the death penalty today will be two experts, Cassandra Stubbs, Senior Staff Attorney with the ACLU Capital Punishment Project, and William Otis, Adjunct Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law School. We're going to hear opening remarks, first from Ms. Stubbs and then Professor Otis, of 8 to 10 minutes each. After that, we'll hear very brief rebuttals from each, after which we're going to take questions from our audience. Please note, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Also, today's call is being recorded for future use as a Practice Group podcast. Ms. Stubbs, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you. The death penalty is a failed government program whose enormous price tag we simply can't afford. Now, why do I say it's failed? It's failed first because it doesn't protect the innocent. Since 1973, over 138 people have been released from death row who were innocent. It's beyond naive to believe that we've not executed an innocent person. For those, including, for example, Justice Scalia, perhaps most famously, who insists still on debating this point, and in terms of a recent case, we can look to the case of Todd Willingham. Mr. Willingham was convicted and sentenced to die for the death of his three children and a fire at his house. The theory of the state at the trial was that the scientific evidence proved he had intentionally set the fire. That evidence turned out to be entirely wrong. A similar kind of evidence was presented in another Texas case, Ernest Ray Willis. Mr. Willis was fortunate when that evidence came to light that the scientific evidence was wrong and that the arson evidence was wrong, Mr. Willis was exonerated. Mr. Willingham was not so lucky. Even though that evidence had come to light, he was still executed by the state of Texas. We can look farther back for an example where the state has actually acknowledged that they executed an innocent person. This year, the governor of Colorado, Bill Ritter, pardoned Joe Arity for a 1936 murder. In that case, Mr. Arity was not even in the town at the time that the murder took place. He had an IQ of 46, which is basically the functioning level of a toddler. The death penalty also failed because it's applied unfairly. We know that decisions about who lives and who dies, made by juries and prosecutors and the justice system in general, are largely dependent on how much money the defendants have, the skill of their attorneys, sometimes the race of the victim, and where the crime took place. If you look at the Anthony Sowell case, that's a good example of the risk of geographic disparities. Clearly, his crimes were horrific. No one would argue that he should not be punished swiftly and severely. But the death penalty in Ohio in the last recent years has been applied really only in a handful of counties surrounding Cincinnati and Cleveland, which is where Mr. Sowell was from. We know it's unfair because it's not being applied to the worst of the worst. If the last year with statistics from 2009, there were over 15,000 murders in this country, and yet there were only 106 death sentences imposed that year nationwide. So less than 1% of murders, every murder involves a horrible crime against an innocent victim. And of 15,000, less than 1% resulted in death. In terms of cases, for every Anthony Sowell, there are cases where the facts are very, very different. For example, Hollywood, he was a defendant who was executed last year after losing his case in the Supreme Court. He was a poor black man. He was mentally retarded and a case with no physical evidence tying him to the crime. But he had terrible lawyers at the trial. On the flip side of the fact that we know that the worst of the worst are not being executed is Gary Ridgway. Gary Ridgway was not sentenced to death. He was allowed to serve life without parole, even though he admitted to the murder and rape of over 70 women. Every recent study has found that there are disparities in the administration of the death penalty. Most frequently in the race of the victim, there are disparities, there are geographic disparities, there are gender disparities. We know it's not being fairly applied. We also know that the death penalty is not deterring. This is a debate that is repeating itself. There were early studies that came out that purported to show that the death penalty deterred. Those were totally debunked. Then the debate was revived a few years ago when a few new studies came out and again purported to say that based on this evidence, the death penalty deters murders. When statisticians looked and economists looked at those studies very carefully, they found that the evidence is simply not there. There's no reliable evidence of deterrence. Those statistics just didn't hold up, and I'd be happy to talk more about that if callers have questions. For those callers who maybe are not statisticians, we can look at common sense examples to understand why there's no evidence of deterrence. For example, the map of falling and rising crime rates in Canada very closely tracks the United States, even though Canada does not have the death penalty. Same with states with the death penalty and without the death penalty. The overall crime and murder trend lines are very similar across jurisdictions. These are common sense ways that we know that the deterrence evidence is just not there. The death penalty doesn't work the way it should. It fails to protect the mentally ill. The criminal justice system is unfortunately often at its worst in the area of capital cases. There's this incredible pressure to solve terrible crimes or to secure a conviction, and that leads to the kind of abuses that we don't even see in routine criminal cases. Scott Turow has written about this, a former prosecutor, someone who was at one point pro-death penalty, talks about the fact that once a crime is quote-unquote solved, there's a lot less scrutiny given to it than there would be in a routine criminal case. There's this incredible pressure to go towards conviction. And we see that this kind of phenomenon happens with mental illness. Even though the states have written laws that say that mental illness should be mitigating, that means that juries and prosecutors should consider it as a reason to give life to a defendant. In fact, juries and prosecutors often treat it as aggravating. The two cases that were chosen today by the Federalist Society for the debate both raise serious mental illness questions. Anthony Sow, the evidence at his trial showed that he had post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, cognitive dysfunction, and psychosis, a very serious mental illness. He was found living with four dead bodies down his hallway. There were serious signs of mental illness, and yet he was given the death penalty. I think the demands, the recent public disclosures about the demands that Breivik have been making similarly show signs of very serious mental illness. You know, he asked for cigarettes, but then he also demanded to be dressed in full military gear when he goes to court. He said if he's going to undergo a mental health evaluation, that it should be with Japanese doctors because they understand the values of honor, never mind that he doesn't speak Japanese. He's demanded to be made the head of Norway's armed forces and that the heads of European governments resign. This is clearly not a person who's in touch with reality. And at the end of the day, the question is, what's the price tag? What are we giving up for this flawed government program? And the answer is literally millions of dollars at this time of fiscal crisis for so many states. In California, there was a study recently by Judge Alarcon, who's one of the Ninth Circuit judges, and Paula Mitchell, a Loyola law professor. They found that since 1978, on the death penalty, California has spent $4 billion. Each year, it's a tune of $184 million more because California has the death penalty than life without parole. What that enormous price tag has bought California is a total of 13 executions. The other studies from other recent states have shown the same thing. There's no question that the death penalty is far more expensive than life without parole. In Maryland, it was almost $2 million per case to try a case capitally than a life case. North Carolina found that a Duke study found that we could save $11 million a year by ending the death penalty. In recent years, New Jersey, New Mexico, and Illinois have all recognized the high cost of the death penalty. In those states, the legislatures and governors stepped up and made the choice to end these expensive, error-filled government experiments and executions. Other states should do the same.
Professor Otis, you want to go ahead with your opening remarks?
Thank you. Kathy has pointed to a number of problems that we frequently hear about the death penalty, and I'm going to address those momentarily. I'd like to start, though, with something that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the basic reason that we have it. I want to do that by telling you a couple of stories. Unfortunately, they aren't stories in the sense of being fictional. They're stories out of the newspaper. And I'll just quote a few paragraphs from one, an Associated Press story. Quote, a longtime sex offender, Joseph Duncan, was sentenced to death Wednesday for the kidnapping, torture, and murder of a 9-year-old Northern Idaho boy after a federal jury, which watched video of some of the brutality, deliberated just 3 hours. Relatives of the victim, Dylan Groney, remained somber as the jury's decision was announced. Duncan murdered Dylan's mother, older brother, and his mother's fiancé to kidnap him and his younger sister, who was sexually abused along with her brother, but survived. Duncan showed no reaction other than smiling as the verdict was passed to the judge. He took Dylan and the boy's then 8-year-old sister, Shasta, to a remote western campsite where he raped, tortured, and threatened them before shooting Dylan and burning his body. Jurors viewed horrifying video Duncan made of him sexually torturing and hanging Dylan until the boy lost consciousness. That's the news story. I might add that Mr. Duncan did not make these videotapes in order to create evidence at his subsequent trial. He made the videotapes because he eventually became worn out after whipping and raping this 9-year-old boy. And while he was relatively fatigued, he used the videotapes to masturbate. I'll tell you one more story that involves what many of you may recognize as a way to die that both children and adults have nightmares about. It may be the nightmare way to die. It involves a case you may be familiar with, that of Jessica Lunsford. And I'll quote again from the Associated Press story. Quote, a Florida judge sentenced John Evander Cooey to death Friday for the kidnap, rape, and murder of 9-year-old Jessica Lunsford. Cooey, a previously convicted sex offender, buried Lunsford alive in 2 black trash bags, with her hands bound and her favorite purple stuffed dolphin tucked in her arms. Circuit Judge Richard Howard said Lunsford's body was found in a grave in Cooey's yard about 3 weeks after she disappeared. Again, quoting the judge, he secured her fate with the second bag. Howard called the murder cold and calculated, causing a slow, suffering, and conscious death. It's often said in the debate over the death penalty that death is different. And indeed, it is different. It was different for Dylan Groney, and it was certainly different for Jessica Lunsford. It's a commonplace in criminal law that the punishment should fit the crime, and it's a related commonplace in every discussion, except the one about the death penalty, that the punishment should reflect the fact of the offense. But abolitionists tell us not only that there is no set of facts about offense behavior that would warrant our keeping capital punishment as an option for the jury in exceptional cases, but that in addressing that question, no set of facts can even be considered. This is quite different from what the founders of our country thought. The framers explicitly contemplated death as a punishment, and in the early days of the Republic, it was applied to more crimes and with fewer safeguards, many fewer safeguards, than today. Of the 116 Supreme Court justices in the nation's history, only 4 have taken the view that the death penalty is per se cruel and unusual punishment. It has been supported by presidents from Bill Clinton to Dwight Eisenhower, Franklin Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. It is currently favored by 2/3 of the public. Now, of course, the fact that the death penalty has a long historical pedigree and is favored by the public doesn't mean that it's right, but it does mean that there's a heavy burden on abolitionists to show that it's wrong. I would submit that abolitionists have not met that burden, and indeed that their principal arguments on examination don't measure up. We are told, for example, that life without parole is the principal alternative to the death penalty and is what we ought to be using. We're told in that connection that life without parole provides two of the important things that are often said in behalf of the death penalty, that being incapacitation and deterrence. In fact, it does not provide either. The classic case for the death penalty, for life without parole not providing incapacitation, is that of Clarence Ray Allen. Allen was the last person executed in California. The story with Allen is that in the course of robbing a place called Franz Market, he killed someone. That crime could have resulted in his getting the death penalty, but it did not. Instead, he received life without parole. But Allen figured, as many manipulative and violent people do, that he was going to beat the rap anyway, even from in prison. So he arranged the murder of one of the witnesses who had testified against him, figuring that with the help of abolitionist organizations, he was going to win his appeal, get a new trial, and the state was going to be stuck. He was indeed going to wind up being one of the, quote, exonerated, because the state would have to drop charges, its principal witness having been rendered no longer available. And he hatched a plan for the murder of that witness. The plan succeeded. The person that he arranged to do the murder, however, killed not only the witness, he killed two other people who happened to be standing by. The two other people were named Douglas White and Josephine Rocha, who was 17 years old and was shot through her heart and stomach. This time he did get the death penalty, too late for those people, but he did get the death penalty and he appealed. The Ninth Circuit, not notorious for being a court of appeals favored by, for example, Rush Limbaugh, had this to say in its final paragraph in Allen's appeal, and I'm quoting now. Evidence of Allen's guilt is overwhelming. Given the nature of his crimes, sentencing him to another life term would achieve none of the traditional purposes underlying punishment. Allen continues to pose a threat to society, indeed to those very persons who testified against him in the Franz Market triple murder trial here at issue, and has proven that he is beyond rehabilitation. He has shown himself more than capable of arranging murders from behind bars. If the death penalty is to serve any purpose, it is to prevent the very sort of murderous conduct for which Allen was convicted. So I would respectfully submit that Kathy's belief that it's the imposition of the death penalty that has resulted in the killing of innocents is not correct. In fact, as this case proves as an adjudicated fact, it was the failure to impose and carry out the death penalty that resulted in the deaths of at least three innocent people. It also, that penalty does deter. I know that there have been studies that have reached contrary results, but the fact of the matter is that at least three times as many studies have reached the conclusion that the death penalty deters than have reached the opposite conclusion. One in particular that I want to point to is one by Professor Mokan at the University of Colorado, who was interviewed by MSNBC and said this: "Science does really draw a conclusion. It did. There's no question about it," said Professor Mokan, an economics professor at the University of Colorado. "The conclusion is there is a deterrent effect." A 2003 study he co-authored and a 2006 study that re-examined the data each found that execution results in five fewer homicides, and commuting a death sentence means five more homicides. And then it quotes him, quote, "The results are robust. They don't really go away," he said. Quote, "I oppose the death penalty, But my results show that the death penalty deters murder. What am I going to do? Hide them? So here we have, you know, both a case and an anti-death penalty person, an anti-death penalty economist in that petition. Both of them point to the same result. The death penalty does deter murder. It's the imposition of the death penalty. The imposition of the death penalty actually can prevent murder and is the only thing that can be guaranteed to incapacitate people so they won't do it. I think my 10 minutes is up, and I'll leave it to Cassidy for her rebuttal.
I'll just try to respond to a few points. First, the assertion that the death penalty is supported by two-thirds of the public. That is certainly true that, for example, in the most recent Gallup poll, almost two-thirds of the people indicate that they are in favor of capital punishment. But the answer changes when you ask them whether they would prefer capital punishment or life without parole. And when given the option, then opinion is split almost 50-50. So I think this heavy burden that you assign to us is not quite fair. Next, with respect to Clarence Ray Allen, and I'll admit that I'm not perhaps as familiar with the case as you are, but I believe that that was a murder that happened, that he was sentenced for from the late 70s, and that the allegation that he then made these contracts on and arranged for a future murder, or did in fact arrange for a future murder, that happened in the early 80s, you know, when our prison system was very different from the prison system that we have today. And I think if you talk to any warden in the country about the level of incapacitation and the way that prisons look today compared to the 1980s, there's really just no comparison at all. On the issue of deterrence, it sounds like, you know, we're headed towards perhaps a longer discussion about this, but there was a study in 2003 in that same issue that the McCone study came out that you referred to in that same journal, the American Law and Econ journal, that showed that there are long-term prison sentences have a deterrent effect. And those authors, that was Katz, Levinson, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Shusterwitz, found that there was not enough data on capital punishment and that the conclusion that capital punishment deterred was actually flawed. And since then, there have been a number of studies, including by one of the authors, the co-authors of that 2003 piece that you cited, Joanna Shepherd. She went on in 2005 to write another study saying, well, actually, the results are a lot more nuanced. We find that capital punishment increases murder, actually increases murder rates in 13 states, although it deters in 6 states, she said. What the majority of researchers who've gone back and looked at these data have said is that these data are incredibly unstable, that you can add in variables and literally flip the results. And that's why we have to say that there's no real evidence here, that this evidence just doesn't stand up to further scrutiny.
Let me respond to those. The idea that life without parole will be just as good as incapacitating murder is proved not principally by the Clarence Ray Allen case, although it's certainly proved by that. What it's proved by considerably more are the dozens and dozens of murders that happen in prison by previously convicted killers who were legally eligible to be sentenced to death, but who had not been executed. It's true that the judicial system is fallible. What doesn't get mentioned is that the prison system is also fallible, and there is no prison system, just as there is no judicial system, that will ever be able to guarantee infallibility. That being the case, it will continue to be the case that there will be murders in prison, just as there have been up to now, including through the 80s, 90s, and through the first decade of the 2000s. Prisoners convicted of murder and incarcerated under what are thought to be secure conditions have killed their bunkmate, have killed infirmary workers, people who work in the kitchen, counselors, teachers, Other inmates who refuse to give them sexual favors, other inmates in rival gangs, other inmates in different racial groups. There, if we don't have execution, if we don't put some people permanently out of business, they will kill again. And that's not a matter of speculation. Unfortunately, it's a matter of history. I just want to say one more thing about the Willingham case that you mentioned. It remains the case now, just as it did as Justice Scalia wrote his concurrence in Kansas versus Marsh, that there is no neutral authority and that there is no court that has found that we have executed an innocent person in the modern super due process era, that is, in the era since the death penalty was reinstated in Gregg versus Georgia in 1976. It's true that there have been innocent people who've been executed, and you pointed to one case in 1936. There are other cases before then that people pointed to. But talking about those says nothing, in my opinion, about that's relevant to the way the death penalty is administered today. We live in the era of post-Gregg super due process in which the interval between the imposition of a death sentence and its being carried out, when it is carried out, is 12 years. During those 12 years, the sentence is reviewed by appellate courts at the state and federal level time and time again. The principal reason that, as you pointed out in your very opening remarks, the death penalty is so expensive is the degree and the cost and the delay in these time and again motions that are filed for appellate review, most of which, with all respect, are not meritorious, and they're certainly not about factual guilt. What they're really about is running the clock. And if we want to cut down the expense of capital punishment, the way to do it is not to eliminate capital punishment any more than the way to cut down the expense of Medicare is to eliminate Medicare. The way to cut down the expense is look at those features that are causing the expense and reform those. And in the case of capital punishment, what that would mean, repeated run-the-clock, run-the-meter litigation that does not go to factual guilt or innocence.
Okay, well, this is Dean again. Thank you both. There's a lot on the table. We're going to open the floor to your questions now from the audience members. In a moment, you're going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on just one second. With that, let's go to the first question.
Yes, this is from Cincinnati, Ohio. I have a question here. You have both discussed the death penalty in terms of murder. Now, as far as I understand, the Supreme Court has basically limited to those cases, but those are cases. That's something the Supreme Court has made up. Do you think that there, for instance, is any case to be made, even if one were to concede that the death penalty in cases of murder should be subject to abolition, that it ought to be considered in other cases, particularly cases that involve national security?
Well, I'll take the first crack at that. In his 5-4 majority opinion for the court in Kennedy versus Louisiana, in which the court did seem to limit the death penalty only to cases of murder, Justice Kennedy, the author, said explicitly that this opinion was not to be taken to eliminate the death penalty for example, espionage in time of war. So I'll take him at his word. From my own point of view, the death penalty certainly would be it's something our country has, I think, always had for espionage in time of war. And I would go beyond that. I thought Justice Alito had by far the better of the argument in his 4-justice dissent in Kennedy versus Louisiana, in which Justice Alito pointed out that to eliminate the death penalty or to limit it just to murder, and to say that in cases, for example, of aggravated child rape, which was the crime at issue in Kennedy versus Louisiana, it would appear from Justice Kennedy's majority opinion that it wouldn't matter how many victims there were, how young they were, how grotesque the rape was that we were saying never, never, never. That and that is kind of in a nutshell why complete abolition of the death penalty, never allowing the jury to impose it, no matter what the circumstances, is wrong. It's a one-size-fits-all solution that, unlike any other context in criminal law, refuses to look at the facts. I just think it's a big mistake to refuse to look at the facts and to have a priori categorical solutions.
Bob, do you want to weigh in on this?
Sure. I guess I'll respond first to the caller's question and then to Bill's comment at the end there. With respect to the question, I don't. If you're asking me to set aside what the Supreme Court's and whether I think we should have the death penalty for crimes without murder, the answer to that is no. Even in terror cases or any kind of case, if there's no allegation of murder, that seems to me an expansion of the death penalty, and I don't see any principled basis for that. In terms of the comments at the end about how we need the death penalty because there may be some set of facts and therefore we need to keep it open, the truth is that we have had an experiment with the death penalty for decades now, and we know that it's not applied fairly on the facts, and that's the issue about the unfair application. And unfortunately, we have a very bad track record that shows us that we are not able to apply in any kind of systemic, principled way that explains who gets the death penalty and who doesn't in this country.
Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any more questions on our board, so let me ask a question of each of you. For Bill Otis, I don't think you addressed one of the points that Cassie Stubbs made on inconsistent application of the death penalty. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And then for Cassie, if you'd like to address one of Bill's points that there really is no record of innocent people in the modern era being executed, while there is a record of innocent people being killed by convicted murderers who are maybe serving in prison, life without parole, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe you could respond to those respectively.
Yeah, my problem is that I don't know what the definition of inconsistent application means. For example, I started off by talking about two cases, one the murder of Dylan Groney and one the murder of Jessica Lunsford. Now, in the Lunsford case, there was only one murder victim, that being Jessica. In the Dylan Groney case, as I pointed out, reading from the wire service report, in fact, the killer, Mr. Duncan, had killed his mother, his older brother, and the mother's fiance in order to kidnap him and then do the other things he did to him. So there were actually four murders involved in that case. I defy anyone to tell me which of those cases is worse. You know, burying alive a 9-year-old child or killing the family to grab a 9-year-old boy and sexually torture and murder him. I mean, it just boggles the mind. There is no way of saying, of ranking them, of what is the worst of the worst, nor do we need to do that. The only relevant question is not, well, which one is worse than the other. The only relevant question is, does the penalty fit the crime? The idea that a prison sentence, something that you would give to a bank robber, to someone who sells cocaine to a 16-year-old, to someone who knocks over the 7-Eleven, the idea that we would give a sentence to the killer of Dylan Groney or to the person who buried alive Jessica Lunsford, a sort of sentence that is qualitatively identical to the kind of sentence you'd give those people, the cocaine seller, the guy who knocked over the 7-Eleven, to me just doesn't make any sense. And I take it from the overwhelming public support for the death penalty that it doesn't make any sense to most members of the public. Either, if the punishment is to fit the crime, the idea that just a prison sentence fits burying a child alive, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make a grain of sense. And neither does the idea of consistency of application. What you should do in considering the sentence for murder or, to my mind, crime, very, very gross crimes other than murder, such as aggravated child rape or espionage in time of war, is you look at the individual case one at a time, which is the same thing we do, indeed the same thing we insist upon doing in every other aspect of criminal law. And if at the end of the case the jury concludes unanimously, as is the law almost everywhere, that the death penalty is the only punishment that fits the crime, so be it. That was okay with the framers, and it should be okay with us.
What about, Bill, that speaks to inconsistency with regard to criminal acts. What about inconsistency in its application with regard to the race of the perpetrator or even the gender of the perpetrator?
Well, I'm glad you reminded me of that. As to the gender of the perpetrator, it's absolutely true that men are far more frequently sentenced to death than women are. The reason for that is not that society has it in for men. That's ridiculous. Society does not have it in for men. The reason is behavior. Men commit the kind of violent, grotesque murders that result in the death sentence far more frequently than women do, and therefore they are given the death sentence far more frequently than women are. As to the race question, it used to be the case that abolitionists would argue that that black people were picked out disproportionately to receive the death sentence, much more so than white people were. It turned out that studies supported no such thing. There is no, according to the very studies the death penalty abolitionists cite, including the Maryland study, black people are not picked out on account of their race to receive the death penalty. The kind of racial difference, and therefore I just might say, the definition of racial discrimination as it has always been understood in every other context, which is discrimination against a person to receive harsher treatment, does not exist according to these very studies. The kind of thing that is now being talked about as racial discrimination is not a disproportion in the race of the people selected to be prosecuted in a capital case. It's in the race of the victim. But the race of the victim, although there is a disproportion in the race of the victim, that is most that is best explained not by racism, which you would think would show up in selecting the race of the defendant, where it does not exist. The reason that that there's a disproportion of the number of white victims is that death penalty, that it's hard to get the death penalty. It's hard to get a prosecutor to pursue the death penalty or for a jury to give the death penalty in the inner cities where blacks are disproportionately, blacks and therefore black victims are disproportionately located. Although liberals, taken as a whole, favored the death penalty, they favored by a lesser margin than the population at large. In the inner cities where liberalism holds sway and where blacks are concentrated, it's very hard to convince the prosecutor to bring a death penalty prosecution. And that is the reason that there are fewer black victims at the point of the gun of the person who commits the murder. The geographic disparity has to do with political attitudes against the death penalty. And the answer is not to have fewer death penalties. The answer is for inner-city prosecutors to take more seriously the lives of black victims and to pursue the death penalty more frequently, not to abolish it.
Okay, I had a question for Ms. Stubbs, but I'm going to give you a chance to respond to what Bill just said in a moment. But before that, a reminder to folks on the call, our callers, if you would like to ask a question of your own, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And with that, Ms. Stubbs, let me give you a chance to respond to what Bill Otis just said.
Thanks. With respect to the idea that the penalty doesn't fit the crime because somehow we're giving out life without parole sentences to other kinds of criminal violations like dealing cocaine, that I find that argument totally unpersuasive. Life without parole is a very serious penalty. It is literally means that you will die in prison. You will spend every waking, breathing day of your life incarcerated. It is very different from a 10-year sentence. It is very different from an 8-year sentence. It is very different from a 40-year sentence. You have no hope of release. You have no hope of ever getting out of prison. And I think there can be no suggestion that we are punishing lightly as a society when we impose life without parole. I think the point made about the race of the victims, honestly, sounds fictional to me. The studies about geographic disparities and race disparities, they're all part of large regression analyses, and these look at a whole host of factors, and they've found that when you control for the factors, so when you take into account, for example, does this person live in an urban area or a rural area, that race of the victim disparities persist. In other words, they still show race of the victim disparities. And this theory that prosecutors are not going after the death penalty in inner cities, I think that's totally wrong. For example, I talked in my opening remarks about Ohio and the fact that we really see the death penalty happening in Ohio, in Cleveland, and in Cincinnati. There was a very high-profile, horrific murder in a rural area in Ohio, where a man had murdered a family and hid the bodies in a tree, and it got a lot of press and was unquestionably a terrible case. That case resulted in a life without parole. That was in a very small town in Ohio. In contrast, Cleveland and Cincinnati, cities with large African American populations, very dense urban cities, the kinds that Bell's referring to, that's where we see the death penalty happening. So I don't think there's any statistical evidence that it suggests that that's the explanation. And I would also take issue with the suggestion that there have been no studies of discrimination against race of the defendant. Although it's true that race of the victim has shown up in study after study and state after state, North, South, Colorado, California, Florida, Maryland, North Carolina, New York, I mean, all of these states have shown that prosecutors are more likely to seek the death penalty if the victim is a white person. You hold everything else the same, and they're going to seek the death penalty more often if the victim is white. They have not universally found a race of the defendant, but that doesn't mean that no studies have found a race of the defendant. In North Carolina, for example, there was recently a big statewide study. Statewide did not find that effect, but did find it in some counties. And so that's more nuanced, and the results are more mixed there. And then finally, just on the area of gender disparities, there have been studies that have looked at, sophisticated controlled regression studies that have looked at holding the facts the same, are women being sentenced the same at similar rates as men. If you take, for example, infanticide cases, child murder cases, you see that men are disproportionately punished with the death penalty over women in a whole host of areas. And it can't be explained just by the fact that there are more murders by men, which is true, but even holding that into account, there's a discriminatory effect there.
Bill, you want to take just 60 seconds to respond, and then we do have a question from the audience.
Yes, as the last thing that Kathy was mentioning, murders by men. The thing about it, it's not just that men are much more likely to commit murder and commit many more murders. They are also more likely to do it in the ways that provoke a death penalty, to use grotesque and extreme violence, just to beat someone to death, again, to belt them with a baseball bat 40 or 50 times, or to stab them 40 or 50 times. That you see with men. You almost never see that with women. But that's the kind of thing that will provoke the death penalty. One more word on this race of the defendant versus race of the victim. Again, what has always been understood by the phrase racial discrimination is that person X is picked out for disparate and worse treatment because of the race of person X. And that is not what is going on with race of the victim studies. Race of the victim studies purport to show not that, you know, individual X is picked out for prosecution or for the death sentence because of his race, but something different from that. That's simply not racial discrimination, as it has always been understood up to now. And the one more thing I want to add about disparate treatment from one county or one city to the next is, of course, the framers' federalism presupposes disparate laws. For example, there are some states that outlaw point blank the death penalty, and other states like Virginia, Texas, Missouri, that impose it pretty frequently, even among the states that do have death penalty. There's nothing wrong with that. The framers of our Constitution contemplated and encouraged by having a federated system, a federal system, that different states would adopt different laws, and that's all that's happening.
Okay, we have a question from our audience, so with that, let's go to the next question from the audience. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Tom Getty in Sacramento. Bill, just a question for information. Does Kennedy versus Louisiana reach or could reach treason? And what is it that in treason you have to proffer evidence of actual deaths, or how do you reach the death penalty on treason?
No, I don't believe in cases of treason you have to show that an actual death occurred. I haven't read Kennedy versus Louisiana for a while, but my memory is pretty strong that the majority opinion does say that they are not purporting to decide that in cases of espionage or treason that did not result in death, that capital punishment would be off the table. And of course, there's a very famous case in Re Quirin, a World War II case, in which six members of a German submarine crew landed in the United States in New Jersey. They were captured before they did any damage, much less killed anyone. They were executed. I believe they were executed within 3 months. I think they were captured in either April or May of 1942. They were executed in August of that month on the orders of President Roosevelt. And they were executed before They had filed a Supreme Court case, and there is a Supreme Court case about it, as I say. The name is In Re Quirin. The Supreme Court did approve the executions, but only after Roosevelt had executed them. So our country has a tradition of executing people who commit espionage in wartime. It's impossible for me to believe that the Supreme Court would overrule that case, nor is there any basis for overruling it.
Ms. Stubbs, do you have anything on this point?
No, I think that's an accurate description of Kennedy, that that it was limited to the question of whether the death penalty was proportionate for child rape under the Constitution and did not specifically address this question of treason.
Right. Okay. Again, if you have a question for either of our presenters, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Ms. Stubbs, earlier I posed a question to you that I didn't think we gave you a chance to answer, and that's that Professor Otis posited that in the modern era, at least, there is no definitive proof that an innocent person's been executed, but there is plenty of proof that innocent people have been killed by convicted murderers who escaped the death penalty and might even be serving under life without parole. I wonder if you want to respond to that.
Yeah, thanks. This is an argument that's frequently made by defenders of the death penalty, that we don't have definitive proof because we don't have a government that has come forward and said, yes, we executed in the modern era. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes the Cameron Willingham case so interesting. The murders, the supposed murders, the arson fire happened in 1991. He was convicted at a trial, and based on this, what I think everyone in the country would agree, it was bad arson science. That bad arson science came before Governor Rick Perry in 2004. They sent an expert letter in, and the expert said, hey, wait, this was all wrong. All literally every single one of the points of the arson expert who testified at the trial was wrong. You need to stay the execution, take some time. Governor Perry did not stay that execution. He went forward with it, and he was executed. So then there's been a huge effort to try to exonerate fully, to prove, to get an innocence finding in that case. And really, the Innocence Project in New York went about it and has tried to go about it in two ways. First, they tried to get the Texas Forensic Science Commission to investigate his case. They presented a whole bunch of evidence, and right before they were scheduled to have their findings, the governor, Perry, at that point, replaced key members of the commission. He appointed a district attorney. That commission eventually issued basically what was like a prospective report saying, okay, here are the standards that should be employed. All of those standards would have helped Cameron Todd Willingham. They would have exonerated him. They would have meant that his conviction was overturned. And then they asked for a letter from the Attorney General about whether or not they could actually rule about this evidence that was presented way back at Willingham's trial. And the Texas Attorney General, an arm of the governor, said, no, you can't do it. They then moved, the family members moved in the trial court for an actual finding of innocence. They wanted to have a court hearing because they wanted to be able to present this evidence, and they wanted this elusive declaration of innocence so that they could put to rest, even though the science was completely clear, they wanted a judicial finding. And the state fought that. They appealed it. That trial has not been able to go forward. And so, you know, I find it somewhat disingenuous to say that there's no government finding when, of course, the government is not in the government's interest. Rick Perry, I suspect, does not want to say, I executed an innocent person, and it appears that he's going to go to some lengths to hide that. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been an execution of an innocent person in the modern death penalty era. And if we just look at the sheer number of exonerees, how many people we know we got it wrong, it must be true that we have executed at least one innocent person. And there are a number of websites that detail, I mean, Cameron Todd Willingham is one of the compelling cases. There are a handful out there where newspapers around the country have done in-depth investigations and have found that there's very strong evidence of innocence of people who have been executed.
Professor Otis, you want to respond briefly? You've got another question from the audience.
Yeah, I did. I don't think that I said that there has been no government finding of innocence. There has been no finding of innocence by any neutral body. That includes the ABA, if you want to count the ABA as neutral, even though they have endorsed a moratorium on the death penalty. No neutral body has found that an innocent has been executed. It's true that abolitionists are focusing on the Willingham case, and Cassie was mentioning that there was an attempt to get a judicial finding there, and that attempt, was derailed. Let me tell you the reason that it was derailed. There is a statute in Texas that provides for a court of inquiry, and that is the judicial setting in which abolitionists sought finding of innocence for Willingham. The statute provides that the judge who convenes the court of inquiry can't be the judge who sits on it, anticipating exactly what was going on. The judge who convened the court of inquiry is a guy by the name of Charlie Baird, who is an anti-death penalty zealot. And he took the case for himself because he wanted this to be his big show. The reason it got derailed is that the Texas Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, the statute is you can't just take a case for yourself and then go ahead and decide it. You have to send it to a different judge. Well, he wouldn't send it to a different judge, and it was for that reason, to avoid a predetermined outcome that the Texas Court of Appeals said, no, wait, you know, this is not the way we're going to go about it. The other thing I would say is that we've been through Todd Willingham before. Todd Willingham is a worthy successor to a fellow named Roger Keith Coleman. For at least 10 years, abolitionists were as indignant and as certain that Roger Keith Coleman was an innocent man who had been executed by the state of Virginia. They said the state of Virginia was hiding this fact and would never produce DNA evidence. DNA had been taken in that case. That the state would never allow testing of that DNA evidence because it would prove that Virginia had executed an innocent man. That wasn't true. The state did allow, and not at a court order. The governor of the state, then Mark Warner, who's now a United States senator and who is a Democrat, did order DNA testing, and the DNA testing proved not that Roger Keith Coleman was innocent, as had been claimed loudly and indignantly for years. It proved he was guilty. And
okay.
Exactly the same thing is going on with Willingham. It is true that there have been advances in arson science since Willingham was tried and found guilty. What's not being mentioned is that even Willingham's leading expert has admitted that he cannot exclude that it was arson. He has said that he has found no reason to believe that it was arson, but he can't exclude that it was arson. What you do in a case like that is you have to look to other evidence. Willingham's own lawyer has admitted that he did it. Willingham's widow, although she has been very inconsistent about this, to be honest about it, the last thing she said was that before he died, he admitted to her that he did it. So there's other evidence to look at. It's not just the arson evidence, which, as I say, is equivocal. The arson evidence is equivocal. What you do in a case like that is you look to evidence that's not equivocal. When his own lawyer says he did it, I mean, what do we want?
Okay, with that, we've got a minute or two left. We've got one question left from the audience, so let's move on to this final question. Go right ahead, caller.
Hello, this is Cincinnati again. Just had a follow-up question. In terms of life imprisonment without parole, are there cases in which such sentences turn out not to be life imprisonment without parole, but the party sentence gets out? Not on the finding of innocence, but on some other grounds?
The answer to that is yes. Of course, the classic case are instances of escape. And that happened. There was a famous Texas case a few years ago in which two murderers and I think three or four other fellows who had been convicted of violent crimes but not murder escaped. And in the course of the escape, they came upon a sheriff's deputy, and they killed him. So people, you know, murderers who are sent to prison for a very long time or for life without parole, that's not a guarantee. There's not going to be an escape or an erroneous release, nor is it a guarantee against two other things. One is that the state legislature will come back a few years later at the behest of organizations like the ACLU or like Amnesty International, who are going to say something very similar to what Cassie was saying, that a life imprisonment without parole is just a slow-motion death sentence, and that it, too, is a violation of the Eighth Amendment because it provides no hope for redemption, no hope for rehabilitation, and that it's just a death sentence very slowly administered. There will be litigation just like that if it isn't taking place already. And the second place is whether or not we have litigation like that, there's no guarantee the future legislature won't say, oh, well, we thought that life without parole was a good idea when we abolished the death penalty, but for reasons provided to us by pro-defendant organizations and the NACDL, we're now going to decide that we're going to take away the without parole part, and the parole hearings will commence next week. There is no assurance that won't happen. And a similar thing has already been introduced in the California legislature, where there's a pending bill that would provide for parole hearings for juveniles who previously had been denied them.
Ms. Dubbs, final thoughts?
Well, just on that point, there's no question that life without parole in every state that has it means life without parole. It means that you are not eligible for parole. No legislature, no governor, no one has been released under a parole who was sentenced for not life without parole. So these speculations about what could happen in the future, none of that has happened. There's no reason to believe that it's going to happen. Life without parole is a secure, safe, constitutional remedy, and it saves. One of the issues that we haven't talked at all about is the cost and the cost of the death penalty. The truth is that is a far more cost-effective way, and it will finally end these decades of problems that we've been having with capital punishment.
Okay. A reminder, our next telephone conference call is going to be next Monday, August 22nd at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's going to be a panel discussion on the pros and cons of felon voting, so I hope you'll join us for that at this same number. And on behalf of the Federal Society, let me thank our call-in audience for your questions and for dialing into our call today. And Ms. Stubbs and Professor Otis, thank you both for your remarks today. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Again, that's federalistsociety.org/multimedia.